And now it's my honor and pleasure to introduce Peter Shankman. We talked last week on the phone before coming here to ETC, and he said that he recently spoke at an organization that's had the likes of Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, other prominent figures, and that he got a text from that lead organizer that his talk blew everyone else out of the water. So I think that we are in for a treat hearing from Peter today. As you've seen in his bio, he's a best-selling author, entrepreneur, and speaker. And so without further ado, I want to welcome and bring up Peter Shankman.
No pressure with that. Good morning. I am, just full disclosure, I'm fighting a ridiculous cold, and my options this morning were Benadryl or Advil Cold and Sinus. I chose the Advil Cold and Sinus, so I'm going to be really wide awake and really, really on. So just want to let you know that. I apologize in advance. I'm already, you know, I'm a born and raised New York City kid who's massively ADHD, so my hyperspeed is, it's going to be fun. This is going to be about a factor of six to that. So we should have a good time. Thank you guys for having me, and thank you to Mir and to Global Rescue for sponsoring this session. I don't have PowerPoint. I'm not going to bore you with slides. I'm going to tell some stories. And before I do, I'm going to give you a couple of housekeeping notes. I am at Peter Shankman on all of the socials. And I encourage you to tweet or share or post. And you don't have to hide that you're doing it. You could pull out your phone. I teach in a university. I know when my students are on their phone. No one looks down at their crotch and smiles. So feel free. You're more than welcome to share. Anything I say is public knowledge. And if you're sharing it, that is a compliment to me. It means that I'm telling you something of value. I'm going to talk about the premise behind the concept of customer service and customer, customer interaction. Essentially, we are, for the first time in our history, at a place where advertising has taken a back seat to experiential. And what do I mean by that? Well, the Stone Age didn't end because of a lack of stone. Okay? Newspapers aren't dying because of a lack of news. They're dying because the people whose jobs it was 50 years ago to tell us where to go, what to eat, where to travel, what to see, what movies to watch, they're no longer needed because we place a higher premium on recommendations from people we know and trust. 50 years ago, though, it was hard to find those people. We had our best friends. We had our small circle of friends. And if those people didn't have the answers we wanted, we went to the newspaper or the magazines. Because of that, it's become a lot easier today. I'm going to talk about that, the concept of the sewing circle. Remember the sewing circle in the 50s? Husbands would go to work. Moms would sit, get together in one house. And they'd darn socks or whatever it is they did in the 50s. And the real purpose of those days was to gossip. What butcher had the best cut of meat? What bakery had the best breads? Who was sleeping with who? You all laugh quietly. When both parents started working out of the home, that died. Well, the sewing circle's back, and it's back from a corporate perspective, a personal perspective, a nonprofit perspective, in the respect that when I want something, I simply look at my circle of friends, which is now not just three people near me, but thousands of people within my world and thousands of their people. And I get a trusted resource. So we're going to touch on that and how that affects you, specifically, with what you do, travel, tourism, from university to nonprofit to for-profit. So who am I and why are you listening to me? I was in graduate school in Santa Barbara, California in the early 90s studying fashion and portrait photography. I wasn't supposed to be doing any of this. I was studying fashion and portrait photography on a beach in Santa Barbara because it was a spectacular way to meet women. And no, I was on a beach with a camera, do the math. And with 18 credits, I lost my financial aid. And the government sent me a letter that said, your parents make too much money, we're taking away your financial aid. And I sent the government a letter back that said, my parents do make too much money. They keep it. The government did not find that funny. And I moved back to New York, and I was living in their basement. And I was hanging out. Is anyone here under 30? Okay, some of the stuff I'm going to say doesn't make any sense to you. I was hanging out in something called the Melrose Place TV Gossip Chat Room. on America Online. Essentially, if you imagine twittering about House of Cards, but it's not a device, it's a screen that's connected to a box on the floor, that's connected to a phone line that connects to the wall. Phones connected to the walls in the 90s. You would type something into this chat room, you'd go get a slice of pizza, you'd come back, someone would have typed something back to you. This is what we did instead of dating. And someone in that chat room said, you know, my company's trying to build a newsroom. Why don't you submit your resume? And I said, sure, I have no experience. This will be great. And I realized that sarcasm doesn't translate online. And I was hired 2 weeks later to become the founding editor of the America Online Newsroom. So for those of us my age and older who remember AOL as the internet, okay, oh my God, you must work for the internet. Like, I went to a room every day with a door that said the internet. Me and Al Gore, we just did all that stuff. But we made up the rules as we went along, and that was my first really experience with customer service, because we were sitting in a room at a building that had internet pipes coming right from the ocean. Like, we had the T1s and the T3s, the fastest internet pipes in the world, connected to our computers, directly to our computers. And we were publishing content every day that looked awesome on our machines because we had these massive pipes, except we were delivering that content to people who lived in very small houses, some might say containers, and in the middle of nowhere, and didn't have fast internet. They were lucky to have a 1200 baud dial-up modem. And so my first realization to customer service was that we weren't thinking like a customer. We were thinking like the owners. And that's a mistake. Because if you do one thing because it's the way you want and it's not the way your customer wants, they'll simply leave. And we were hemorrhaging customers. We had a churn rate at AOL about 30%. It's huge. Until we realized that we weren't thinking like the consumer. You weren't thinking like your clients. We weren't thinking like our consumer. And so we learned how to deal with that very, very simply. Simply by listening to our audience. Now, to touch on that, I left AOL. I moved back to New York. I was consulting for a couple of years. In the summer of 98, I had this idea that I could start a PR firm. And I could do it better and quicker and faster, and it could be the .com PR firm. But it was the summer of 98. I had no money. I was in a studio apartment roughly the size of you. And if you live in New York City, you understand it was literally the size of her. And it was the summer of 98. I had no money. I wanted to start an agency, but it was hard to do when you're broke. There was a movie coming out on video that some of you may have heard of. It was an independent film. It didn't do that well at the box. It was called Titanic. Everywhere you looked, you saw signs of buy Titanic on video. Buy Titanic on video. Get it here. Buy it or we'll kill your family. I figured there had to be a better way, and I figured there had to be people that hated that movie as much as I did. We knew how it ended, for God's sake. I took my rent money. I had 500 t-shirts printed up, and the t-shirts read, "It sank, get over it." And I went to Times Square, and I figured if I could sell 180 shirts at 10 bucks a piece, I'd make my rent money back. Anything more would be profit, and I figured it would take about a week. I sold 500 shirts in 6 hours. I made $5,000. I came home, I threw it up in the air, threw $5,000 up in the air, rolled around it naked. That's what you're gonna take away from this conference. No matter what else I say, that's gonna be embedded in your brain. I called the reporter I knew at USA Today, and I said, I just did something really funny. I thought you'd get a kick out of this. And the reporter said, oh my God, that's hysterical. Are you selling the shirts online? And I went, of course I am. That's why I called you, duh. This was 1998. There was no Cafe Press. There was no WordPress. There was Peter and his craptastic HTML skills. It was buy shirt, click here. You'd click to send me an email that you wanted a shirt. I would mail you my home address. You would mail me a check. For those old enough to appreciate this reference, I built the Rube Goldberg fulfillment process. I sent the link to the reporter, and she said, okay, that's very funny, we'll see what we can do. And I immediately forgot about it. As I mentioned earlier, I'm massively ADHD. It's actually something diagnosed with something much worse called ADOS, which is attention deficit, ooh, shiny. And funnily enough, and this is the only self-promotion I'll do because I just found out today, I have the number one podcast on iTunes called Faster Than Normal, where we discuss ADHD as a gift. I believe that a lot of my success comes from having ADHD. And just today, I wrote a book called Faster Than Normal. It finished about 2 months ago, and it's being published by Random House. And just today, the link went live on Amazon. So I'm very excited about that. So that's my own, thank you. That's my fifth book, and hopefully it'll help a lot of people. But that's my only self-promotion, I promise. Okay, so long story short, I fall asleep. I wake up the next morning. It's 5:30 in the morning. My phone rings. It's the hosting provider of my website asking me if I started advertising. I said, 5:30 in the morning, why are you calling me? What the hell? And they said, sir, normally you get about 100 visitors a day to your website. Most of them are you. Thank you. You've had 37,000 unique visitors. You've taken down our first, second, and third primary servers. You're about to crash our fourth, fifth, and sixth. We only have 7. Story broke on the front page of the Life section of USA Today. Long story short, I sold about 100,000 shirts online. I sold 10,000 shirts online, cleared 100 grand. My father at the time was a high school principal. I had 10 of his detention students come over every day and help box up T-shirts and take them to the post office. I'd give them pizza. It was like P. Diddy's studio sweatshop after school special. And why do I bring that up, and how does that relate to you? Well, here's the thing. If I went into Times Square today with my T-shirts, within 2 seconds, someone would have taken their phone and grabbed a photo of my T-shirt, and there would be 15 Etsy shops or Pinterest sites or whatever selling my idea, and I wouldn't make a penny. So what does that mean for you? Anyone can sell a trip. Anyone can make an airline reservation. Anyone can take a group of people somewhere. I travel 250,000 miles a year. Okay, that is not, I was United's 7th most frequent flyer last year, which is not something that you should ever applaud. It's actually very sad. But I understand being on the road, and I understand that I can travel anywhere, and it doesn't take a lot. I could choose any airline. Why do I keep going back to United? Because they know me, and because I trust them. The airline that drives me, or flies me from New York to Tokyo once every month, or New York to Singapore, or Barcelona next week, I don't care what the plane is. I don't care if it's an Airbus, I don't care if it's a 777, I don't care if it's an 87. What I care about is that when I get to the airport, I'm going to have an easy time checking in. I care that they're going to recognize me, and they're going to smile. I care they're going to treat me just a little better than what we expect. Who flew here for this conference? Who had a good flight? What made it, ma'am, what made it good? Yeah, what made it good?
I was on Southwest. The attendant getting us all on was like, "Hey, Kennedy, congratulations. We just heard you became a grandmother." Blah, blah, blah. It was very personal and energetic.
Okay. Cool. So, but they didn't, let you fly the plane.
No, but they let me take a picture of my daughter's little bear.
Okay. Very cool. So they went above and beyond. Yeah. You're in the minority. Majority of you who raised your hand when I said who had a good flight, and you raised your hand, here's why you had a good flight. You had a good flight because you got there on time, or maybe just a little bit delayed. You had your luggage, and you had the seat you were assigned. When you get on a plane, you sign something called a contract of carriage. The contract of carriage, as you all know, essentially states in basic English, I'll pay you a certain amount of money to fly me to a certain place and back at a certain date and time. That's it. For 99% of you, except for little Miss Southwest Star over here, for the rest of you, that's exactly what the airline did. They didn't do anything more than that. But you're over the moon. Because your expectation was not even close to that. Your expectation was to get to the airport. For whatever, you're flying out of Newark, for whatever reason, Terminal C is totally under construction, there's no pre-check anymore. Right? So you're sitting there for an hour, you will get the probe, you'll get the person who gets pulled over and taken to a private room and probed. That's you. Now you only have 20 minutes to make your flight, but it's okay because your flight's at gate 4, which is right there. Except they moved it to gate 487 without telling you, which is actually 4 airports and 6 states over. So now you're rushing, your luggage is falling out, everything's dropping on the floor, you're having 6 mini strokes. You get to gate 487, and, well, now it's only 14 minutes before boarding, so they gave your seat away. So seat 4B has now become seat 39 bathroom. And you're in the middle seat, crushed between 2 400-pound guys, right next to the bathroom, which, by the way, overflowed and they didn't have time to fix it before they took off. Have a great 6 hours in the air. That's what we expect. So anyone can book a flight. Anyone can book a trip. Anyone can make a tour. What has to separate you guys? Very simple. Trust. The concept of the customer experience and the economy of the next 50 years starts with trust. Because I could probably do my own taxes, but I don't want to. Because I trust the person who's been doing them for the past 15 years for me. Trust is essentially the only thing you sell and the only thing that your universities buy. Because every time a trip is created or promoted or scheduled or advertised, someone's reputation is on the line for it. If I'm coming to you guys, I expect you to create a memorable experience for me. That goes without saying. Show me that I can trust you, and you will alleviate my fears. Because at the end of the day, all I have is my personal brand, my personal reputation. And if I'm creating that tour, and if I'm going to some very wealthy people and saying, I think you should give me money and we're going to do this amazing thing, and it goes south, that's me. As I described it last night in the lounge to a couple of you who were there, I don't know, see you in the audience today. If I'm in the Marriott lounge and the steak or whatever the food they had there in the lounge, if it's bad and I get sick, I don't care that it was a third-party company that made the food. Marriott is on my shit list. Okay? That is what we have to expect. So the premise of I don't care who does it wrong, I don't care who does it right, you have to radiate trust. Because, and Global Rescue, their advertisement said it better than I ever could, their three-minute video, the woman whose kid got sick, who had seizures, they came in, they solved her problem. They could have solved her problem and then killed her dog. It wouldn't have mattered because they solved her problem. And she will spend the rest of her life telling the rest of the world how they solved her problem. So I asked a handful of you last night to email me with the biggest problems you are facing. What keeps you up at night? And what I heard was overwhelmingly similar. How do we adapt to the change in today's society, both technologically and globally? How do we make sure that people know of us? And how do we make sure that we stay relevant? So I'm going to address those points in four very basic points. And this is the core of the concept of the social economy. After I did the t-shirt thing, I consulted for several years, and eventually I stumbled on something that I found out. That's when I found out I had ADHD, and I also found out that I talk to everyone. If you're on a plane next to me, unless you fake your own death, I'm going to know everything about you by the time we land. I'm naturally curious. Only two people in all my flights have ever faked their death. I'm going to know everything about you because I'm curious, and because instinctually, I'm a helper. I like to put good people together. When you work in PR, marketing, or advertising, and you can be a helper, everyone calls you. You're the guy people go to. That's the greatest feeling in the world. Reporters would start calling me, Peter, I'm doing a story on whoever. You know everyone. I need someone who knows about travel. I need someone who knows about Nigerian farming. I'd go through my Rolodex. I'd find someone. And over time, I got a lot more questions that I couldn't answer from journalists. I'm doing a story on someone who knows about how the seat backs and chairs, I mean, how the hell do I know how the seat backs? I'd do my research. 12 hours later, I'd find a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend who worked at USC who had the answer. Took way too long. So I started a small little mailing list. It was on Facebook at the time, called Help a Reporter Out. And Help a Reporter Out, it still exists. It's a free service that would send you an email when a reporter had a query. And if you could answer it, just email the reporter. Reporter gets what they want. You get some free media exposure. Everyone wins. It went from a little Facebook group of my friends to 250,000 people in a year and a half. And because we were sending out three emails a day with about 50 queries from journalists in each email, the day you didn't open it was the day there was a story about your industry. You missed it, and everyone else got it. So you had to open it. I created like email crack. We had a 79% open rate on our emails three times a day, 5 days a week. It was a free service that had a small little text ad at the top. Those small little text ads were bringing in a little over $2 million a year in revenue. It was me on my couch with an overweight cat on either side of me. When I sold that company, it sold very well, and I was floored by how well it did. And I vowed to spend the next year trying to figure out why. And what I came up with was the company that bought us had interviewed 500 of our members. Just a random sampling. And every customer, or every member said the same thing. They said that they felt that they were invested in what I built. Because if they had ever had a problem, they just hit reply to any one of the emails, and it came right to me. I spend about 94% of my day answering emails. And when your customers feel invested, they'll take a bullet for you. When your customers feel invested, they become something called zombie loyalists. Zombie loyalists, you know how zombies, their only purpose in life, eat brains, make more zombies? Zombie loyalists, only purpose in life is because they've had such an amazing experience with you, they have to go and tell the world how awesome you are. They are 14 times more trusted than an advertisement. 14 times. Because they had something happen. That woman with the kid, I guarantee you, she will not shut up about how good Global Rescue is. And mark my words, people are sick of hearing about it. But she's gotten them a lot of business just because they were trusted and there when she had a problem. So I did the research and tried to figure out what I did that was so different that made all these people love the company I built. And the result was zombie loyalists. I'm supposed to tell you that I have Zombie Loyalists, the book, and apparently it'll be in the back afterwards. I'll sign it, I don't know. But here's what I learned. I'm going to give you the four basic rules. And these are the four rules that should help you in this social economy. Because at the end of the day, currency is not currency anymore. Experience is stronger than money. Or to put it another way, no one believes how awesome you are if you're the one that has to tell them. Mia, who haven't I picked on yet? What's your name?
Karen.
Karen, if I meet you somewhere at a conference or something and say, you know, you need the business I do, and let me tell you something, I'm awesome at what I do. Seriously, I am just, you should, let's talk about this right now. You're going to hire me, but you're going to go back to your friend and not even give me the time of day. I usually use this description if I'm in a bar and I meet a woman and go, and I'm amazing, you should come, she's going to throw a drink in my face, because that's the one I've done a lot more research with. But point is, if your friend, though, your colleague, your business associate, says, oh my God, that's Peter Shankman. You know what? He does that exact thing you were looking for. Let me introduce you guys. I used him. He's amazing. You're going to have a great... We're doing business. Because I come from a trusted source. She has no reason whatsoever. Yeah, she looks trustworthy. She has no reason to screw you. She's not out to get you. So you're going to take her opinion at face value. If I screw up, that's going to reflect poorly on her and me. She wouldn't let that happen. So no one believes how awesome you are if you're the one that has to tell them. And in the industries that you're in, the number one question is, oh, well, you know, we work business to business, or we're a nonprofit. We don't have people who, you know, this is not like a consumer thing. This isn't like a restaurant. Let me tell you something. It's exactly like a restaurant. Because at the end of the day, I've never met a university, I've never met a company, I've never met a business that spends money. You know who does? The people in that university, that company, or that business. At the end of the day, people make decisions. People are influenced by the people around them. Anyone ever seen the movie Silence of the Lambs? I love that I could bring a Hannibal Lecter quote to this stage today. Hannibal Lecter said, when he was trying to find the serial killer, we covet what we know. We covet what we know. If I know that you had a great experience, I want that great experience. You are going to make that introduction, and I will trust you to get it. How do we get there? Four basic rules. First rule is the concept of transparency. As I said earlier, we expect bad customer service. Here's the thing. I don't need you guys to be great. I don't need you to walk out of here. Tony Robbins is a friend of mine, and he has that whole walk on fire thing, and he's awesome. I love Tony. I don't need you to walk on fire. That's very, very hard. Don't need you to do it. Way too early to walk on fire. All I need you to do is be a little bit better than expected. And here's the beauty part. We expect to be treated in any customer interaction, whether it's commercial, nonprofit, consumer, we expect to be treated like crap. Let's face it. Remember the airport? We don't expect good. So I don't even need you guys to be great. I need you to be a couple of levels above what we expect. I need you to smile at me when I walk on the plane. That, did you see how fast her hand went up when I said who had a good flight? They smiled and they let her kid take a photo in the cockpit of her bear. I have a 3-year-old. I know how big that is. They didn't do anything magical. They got it there on time. I got an email from United when I landed yesterday that my books, which I brought with me, got on an earlier flight somehow. I don't know how that happened. My books arrived before me. But what do you expect when you open the email? Oh, my books are lost. I literally thought I was going to have to explain to you guys why I don't have books. Oh, my books. Holy crap, they're here. Who expects that? So the four rules. I need you to be a little bit better than that. How do we do it? First rule is the concept of transparency. Here's what transparency means in unbelievably simple language. You are going to screw up. At some point, something is going to go wrong. Whether it's your fault or not, whether you've outsourced it or not, whatever the case is, you're going to screw up. It happens. We're human beings. When you do it, there is only one way to handle it, regardless of whose fault it is. The first words out of your mouth when you talk to the client, when you talk to the school, whatever it is, after the screw-up is, we are going to fix it. I don't want to hear whose fault it is. I don't want to hear why it happened. I don't want to hear, especially don't want to hear that it's never happened before. Oh, lucky me. I'm the first. When I call you, I have a problem. And I want to hear that you're going to fix it. I don't even want to know how you're going to fix it. I just want to be reassured that you are going to. Because let's face it, I've traveled to some of the places that Mir posted about. I don't want to have a problem there. And when I do, I damn well want to have someone who's going to help me out of it. Transparency simply means we're going to fix the situation. Because here's why. When you fix the situation, how many of you order from Amazon? Easy, right? Simple. How many of you ever tried to return something to Amazon? A little harder? No, exactly. It's very easy to do. Amazon understands that the promise isn't, we'll get you your package. The promise is, what happens if something goes wrong? Google, in New York City and major cities, there's something called Google Shopping Express, which for people who live in New York without a car is the greatest thing in the world. I go online, I say, I need diapers, I need whatever, and they arrive an hour later. I don't know how, but they're there. I went online and I said, I need one box of size 5 diapers. And I probably did it wrong, but for some reason, 5 boxes of size 1 diapers showed up. It was a Saturday morning. 5 boxes of size 1 diapers in an apartment in New York City is pretty much half the apartment. I'm like, and so I send an email to Google. I'm like, hi, I think there's a screw-up. They're like, not a problem. Just UPS them back to us. I'm like, I'm in New York City. That means I have to carry them to a UPS store. I have to find, I don't know how to do that. I got a kid. The response email I got was, you know what? Totally not a problem. We see that you're in New York City. We're actually sending someone on the way over with the one box of size 5s, and we'll take the 5s out of your way. Don't even stress. All good. 20 minutes later, the wrong ones were out of my apartment. The right ones were in. You think I'm ever going to shop anywhere for diapers or paper towels or toilet paper about Google Shopping Express? This is Google. This is like God sending me an email saying, not a problem. We'll fix it. And by the way, you can now levitate your cat. Google on a Saturday morning was able to fix my problem. I love Google. What can you do to create that level of transparency? Well, here's a very simple way. Be honest. You're going to screw up. When you do, own it. And once you've owned it, you'll win. You'll fix the problem. And the client will be thrilled. And here's why. There is no greater lover in the world than a former what? There's no greater lover in the world than a former hater. When I have a problem and it's not fixed, or I have a problem, period, I am on the path to becoming a hater. You fixed my problem, and now I'm happy again? You've turned my path not only away from hate, but now I'm a lover because you went out of your way to solve my crisis. Oh my God, they fixed my problem. Greatest response ever. I have to tell the world how great these people are. And you will. Because the only thing we love talking about more than a company screw-up is when a company goes out of their way to make us feel special. If you don't believe me, search Twitter. Transparency. Own it when you screw up. And if you want a real-world implementation of that, on one side, I'm going to go political now. On one side, you have a gentleman by the name of Elliot Spitzer. On the other side, you have a gentleman by the name of Anthony Weiner. Elliot Spitzer was the governor of New York, and when he was accused of sexual impropriety, he stepped down, apologized, and was gone. He was gone. Left the country, could not find him for a year. He was gone. He came back, very contrite, apologized again, hosted a CNN show. That man will be back in public office in 5 years. Mark my words. On the other side, a gentleman named Anthony Weiner. Anthony Weiner for those who don't know New York City, was going to be the next mayor of New York. This isn't up for debate. This is fact. He was going to be the next mayor. He had the backing of the Clintons. He had a ridiculously attractive wife. He had a lot of money. He had support of the unions. He was going to be the next mayor. All he had to do was not screw it up, which proved very, very difficult. When he was accused of sexual impropriety, had he simply gotten on stage and said, you know, my fellow New Yorkers, I was trying to have some sexy time with my wife. I don't know how to use the phone. I thought I was sending a text. I was using the Twitter. My bad. We would have mocked him for 12 hours, as is required by New York City law. And then someone else would have done something stupider, and we would have forgotten about it, and he'd be mayor. He kept the story alive for 6 weeks by denying. I won't hate you when you screw up. I'll hate you when you screw up and either don't fix it or lie about it. And what's really interesting is that, and I'm not choosing a political side here, that's not what I'm about, but we are in an age right now where the premise of lying is almost an accepted fact. And so if you can be just a little bit better than that, you're going to win. All Anthony Weiner had to do was own that, and he'd be mayor. He'll be lucky to be the most popular history professor at the University of Arkansas. And I'll tell you a really funny side reference to that. I was about to go on TV. I was in the green room at Fox News about to go on the O'Reilly Factor to discuss Weiner's situation. When he announced in a press conference that he was hacked. It was about 4 weeks in, he announced that he must have been hacked by the Chinese or the Russians. I'm in the green room sitting next to Geraldo Rivera, of all people. And I turned to Geraldo, I'm like, Geraldo, this is BS. No one knew who this guy was. He wasn't popping. The Russians, first of all, they hacked his zipper? How do you do that? Geraldo sits there and he goes, oh, that's a really interesting story. But yeah, that's very, putting on his makeup. Geraldo goes out to do the A block on O'Reilly, and I'm scheduled to do the C block. And Geraldo goes out, and I'm prepping. I'm like, yeah, this can be my story. I'm going to talk about how it's ridiculous. Geraldo goes out, and Bill O'Reilly says, Geraldo, did you see that press conference coming? What do you think about that? And Geraldo says, you know, Bill, I've been giving this a lot of thought. I don't think he was important enough to get hacked. I mean, no one knew who he was. I'm sitting in the back going, son of a bitch. So remember what I said about making sure you brand everything you do back to you? Because, yeah, lesson one. Own it. Brand it. Be transparent. When you screw up, own it. Make sure you have a plan in play and execute. You will take the hater into a lover, and lovers tell everyone. Happy February 14th, by the way. That's rule one. That's transparency. Rule two is the concept of relevance. Here's why relevance is so brutally important. As I mentioned back in the 50s, it was very easy to, things were different. And you got your news in the 50s from two ways. You got your news in the morning from the newspaper, and in the evening from the nightly news. How many of you get your news from a newspaper today? And I still read the Sunday Times. I think we should support quality journalism. Newspaper? Okay. TV? Today Show. How many of you get it? That was a trick question. That's not really news. That's entertainment. How many of you get your news from blogs? Podcasts? Okay. Twitter? Facebook, the web, radio as you're driving in. Okay. Everyone raised their hand something different. That means your audience, whether you have a school or 100 people who create trips or anything, no matter how big or small your audience in today's world is fractured. Which means that if you have 20 people in your audience, 15 of whom are decision makers, every single one of those 15 wants their information in a different way. I switched doctors last month because my doctor called me, my GP called me, and he goes, or his assistant, his admin, whatever, called me and said, Ms. Shankman, we were updating our forms and we noticed you didn't fill out your fax number. I go, okay, and I said, my fax number is 1986. And they go, sir, that's only 4 digits. I'm like, no, that's not my number. That's the last year I had a fax machine. All I ask of any company with which I do business, and all your clients will ask of you, is to understand how they like to get their information and give it to them the way they want. I get my news on podcasts that had been downloaded over the course of the middle of the night. I'm very strange. I'm up at around 3:45 every morning. I'm one of those really annoying early rising people. And I have a daughter, and so when I have my daughter, I get up and I go onto my bike. I do Ironman triathlons, and I know you're looking at me and going, no, Peter, you're confused. You watched the movie Ironman while sitting in your ass eating popcorn. But no, I've actually done two Ironman. I'm training for a third this summer. Who clapped? Is that someone who's done an Ironman or a triathlon? Five marathons. You get my business card, which is also a $10 Starbucks card. So thank you very much. What's your best time?
Oh, you don't want to know.
Tell me. Tell me.
I too don't look like a marathon.
Okay. Okay. Like sub five?
Five.
So okay, let's take that. Sub five. Awesome. That's actually pretty good. My best marathon was the New York City Marathon in 06. I ran a 3:58. I will never see that time again. But my point being, I get my news via podcast of download the night before. On the days I don't have my daughter, I'm in Central Park, usually by 4:45, running or cycling or swimming. As a matter of fact, if you Google me, I'm the idiot who got arrested for exercising in Central Park, quote-unquote, before it opened. I've lived in New York my whole life. I'm a born and raised city kid. I didn't know you could close nature. And when the cops said, what are you doing here? And I'm sitting there in spandex. Really? Seriously? Sexual favors for crack. What do you think of that? Turns out, wrong answer. But that's how I get my news. I get my news via podcast in the morning because I have no time during the week to read something or to look at the web. So the podcasts I go to are the ones that understand and give me the information. They're downloaded by 2 a.m. so I can get my news when I wake up at 3:45. If you don't know how your audience likes to get their information, they're not going to become invested in you. You have to get that knowledge. So how do you find it? The answer is actually incredibly simple. Ask them. It has never been easier in today's society, in today's economy, to ask every single customer or client you have, how do you like to get your information, and give it to them the way they want. When you give them the information the way they want, excuse me, they become invested in you, because that is the first, usually the very first sign that you listen. It's okay. No, the first one's free. Second one I get to answer. So it is very, very simple. If they feel, holy crap, I asked for text messages and they're texting me. This is great. That's the first level of trust. That's relevance. Give people information the way they want. If you do, they'll come back to you. And here's the interesting thing about relevance. It has to be real. You can't fake relevance. I work with a nonprofit animal rescue society in the Midwest. I discovered in my spare time I jump out of airplanes. I'm a licensed skydiver with about 400 jumps. And a friend of mine was killed in a base jump about 10 years ago. And some people play golf. I never understood that I jump. And when she was killed in a base jump, her husband said, donate to this animal rescue society where she volunteered. So I sent him a check. And about 2 months later, they sent me a coffee table book. It was just 2007, 8, I guess. I was living in New York City. I didn't own a coffee table. And I looked at this book, and I'm like, this is pretty. I'm never going to look at this again. I threw it in a corner. And every day I'd have to leave my apartment and pass this book that's now sitting in my corner that I'm not doing anything with. And it really irked me, right? And so I got on the phone. I went to talk with their head of giving. And I'm like, well, why would you send me this book? Why wouldn't you send me a YouTube link or something that I could share with friends and maybe spread your message a little bit? Well, sir, we believe that most of our donors are older. And as such, we're sure that they prefer print. I'm like, oh, so you've done research on this. Okay. I say, well, no, we sort of assumed. I'm like, they really pissed me off, so I joined their board. And we spent the next year interviewing every current and past donor. And shock of shocks, 94% of them would prefer to get their information online. So we launched a YouTube page. We launched a Facebook channel. We launched a Twitter account. We launched an email mailing list. In the following year, donations to this nonprofit went up 37%. And they saved over $500,000 on printing, mailing, and reproduction. I don't need you to be awesome. I need you to listen. Listen to your audience. Give them what they want. They will love you. That's rule two. That's relevance. I'll give you one more point on relevance before we go to rule three. You can't fake relevance. You can't fake caring. You can't fake any of these rules. Like I said, I travel ridiculously nonstop on United, and by and large, they're a great airline. I'm a very big fan. After every flight, I get an email from them, and it says, please tell us about your flight. How was your experience? And I always answer, it was great, it was fine. I should give them 10s and all the boxes. The last line of the survey. And by the way, of course, the survey comes from, you know, we care about your experience, and the email's from do not reply ever at united.com. But okay. The last line of their survey is, please tell us on your, what can we do on your next flight to make it better? For 412 flights in a row, 412 as of, as of yesterday, in a row, for 412 flights in a row, I've answered this survey, and now it's just become a game. The last line is the same. On my next flight, please refer to me as Peter, Lord of the Skies. Now, here's the thing. I don't ever expect United to do that, ever. But if I'm one of their top 1% of flyers, and what's called global services with them, if I'm one of their top 1% of their flyers, you know what I would like? Maybe by the 350th time that I've done this, I get a phone call that starts off with something like, hey, asshole, we're never going to do that. Stop. Because that would tell me that they're listening. If I haven't heard anything in over 400 survey responses, well, that's maybe 0.1% disingenuous. And that might get me thinking, well, what happens if I do have four really bad flights in a row? Are they going to respond? 0.1% disingenuous, I'm probably not going to leave United for that. I won't. But you know what it does? It opens a door. It opens a door for Delta Airlines or American or Virgin to infect me with their customer service so that I no longer am a zombie loyalist to United, but I go over to them. What's stopping Delta? If I have four flights in a row and you know I'm tweeting about it or posting about it, and I already have that 0.1% of that door open from United where they didn't respond, what's stopping Delta from coming and saying, Mr. Shagman, it's all your tweets. Can we match your status? We have drugs. What's stopping them? And what's stopping me from saying, no, 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 I'm good with United. I don't need you to be awesome. I need you to be honest. That's relevance. Rule three, concept of brevity. The irony that I have an hour up here and I'm talking about brevity. So, raise your hand again if you're under 30. Anyone on this side? Who else? Under 30, guys. Show me a name. Show me hands. What's your name?
Crystal.
I'm going to tell you a story. And don't worry, you'll get a Starbucks card for my picking on you. Crystal, all the way back in the 80s, a bunch of guys got together and they said, we want to take the songs you hear on the radio. Oh, that's okay. She's not going to talk anymore. I said, we're going to take the songs you hear on the radio, and we want to make little, the radio was like Pandora before the internet. Okay. They said, we want to make little movies out of these songs, and we're going to call these movies videos, and we're going to create a television network to play these videos 24 hours a day, and they called it MTV, or music television. Now, I know this makes no sense to you, because for as long as you've been alive, MTV has been a reality channel. But I swear to you, Crystal, before Snooki or what, I'm 13 and pregnant, whatever crap they're showing, before all this stuff, children of the 80s, can I get a show of hands? Crystal, God forbid you are in our way as we were trying to get home to watch the 4 p.m. world premiere video from, like, Madonna. She's like Lady Gaga with children. Or Duran Duran, or Michael Jackson. This was our life. But someone wasn't happy about it. It's an attorney general under Ronald Reagan. Anyone know who the attorney general under Reagan was? You get a Starbucks card. Nope, second term. Meese. When was the last time you heard the name Ed Meese? Fight amongst yourselves for who called it first, and then come up to me later, I'll give you a card. Attorney General Ed Meese under Ronald Reagan. He was a little upset about MTV because he believed, in his words, that his quote, the Japanese were going to kick our asses because of the MTV. Anytime a politician puts the word the in front of something that doesn't need it, question them. The MTV, the Twitter. Why did he say that, though? He said that because he believed that MTV was giving us a 3-minute attention span. And that 3-minute attention spans was going to ruin the next generation of people. Okay. A 3-minute, that's some funny stuff right there. I look around the room. Android, iPhone, Android, iPhone, BlackBerry, seriously. Wow. Go you, man. 2007 call. They want their stuff back, but that's good. iPhone, laptop. I'd give my right arm to talk to an audience with a 3-minute attention span. Study came out of Stanford. I think it was Stanford. Don't quote me on that. I think it was Stanford. About 5 years ago. Average attention span for someone between the ages of 18 and 65, roughly 2.7 seconds. 2.7 seconds to get information to them for the first time. If you've already talked to them before, it upgrades to about 5 seconds. 5 seconds before you get bored, 5 seconds before they get somewhere else, before they find something else that can help them. The average person looks at exactly 3 links on Google. 1% of all searches actually make it to the second page. Why do I bring that up? Because if you have 2.7 seconds to reach your audience, brevity has to rule the day. Let's talk about 2.7 seconds is roughly 140 characters. What's 140 characters? Okay, it's not Twitter, and let's stop right there. I use Twitter, I'm a fan of it, at Peter Shankman, but I don't believe in Twitter. And here's why. 91% of the world has been involved in the sending or receiving of at least one text message. 6% of America has sent or received a tweet. Where's your audience? I work with Huawei. They're the third largest handset manufacturer after Apple and Samsung. They power 70% of the global infrastructure for third world countries. No one in third world countries is tweeting. They're texting like fiends. What's the difference? On September 11, 2001, I was third for takeoff on the runway at Newark Airport on a United flight heading to the West Coast when the first tower was hit. I found out later I was 10 flights behind Flight 93. All my parents knew at that time was their only child was on a United flight heading to the West Coast around that time. All I knew is that both my parents were working downtown at NYU around that time. We couldn't get in touch. Tried for an hour. I couldn't send them a obviously, cell phones were down. Couldn't send them a phone call. An hour into this nightmare, I was able to send my parents a text message that read, "Not my plane." Sent to my father's phone. That was the first time my father had ever sent or received a text. I imagine him getting confused. It was a flip phone. I imagine him seeing the text icon, confusing it with the voicemail. I don't have a voicemail. Why does it keep saying, how do I get rid of this thing? I don't know. That was the first time they've ever sent or received a text message in their lives. It's 15 years later. 16 years later. I can't get them to stop texting me. It's not funny. They went to Asia about 4 months ago. They're NYU professors, so they take students on tours. They went to Asia about 4 months ago with their kids. It was like I was there. They have WhatsApp now, so it was like I was there with pictures. And 12 hours in the future. From 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. every night for 2 weeks, my phone would beep every 5. It's a Japanese dog. It's a Japanese tree. It's a Japanese. She sent me dinner. It's Japanese food. Mom, over there. It's, yeah, hi. No, everything's fine. They call it food. You're in Japan. It's, okay, good. Right. They're not stupid people. They're NYU professors. They get the concept of texting. God knows they do. They don't tweet. They follow me on Twitter because they want to know what I'm saying. And when I say something self-deprecating, which is usually once a day, my mother calls me to discuss it, which is like my going to your house to see if you got the FedEx. My father replies. Not to at Peter Shankman. He replies like it was a text message. He doesn't know the difference. He replies to Twitter. If you read my father's stream, yes, I remember that. Stop it. 42. Last night. How about tomorrow? A poodle. What the hell? I bring that up because I don't want you guys to get distracted by the next great shiny thing. The basics are still the best. Email, phone calls, face-to-face. Okay? I'm not saying don't use the shiny things. The shiny things are great, but don't rely on them as the end of days. Only use them if your audience tells you they want you to use them. Look at it this way. Having an audience is a privilege. It's not a right. Having clients is a privilege. It's exactly like wearing spandex. The day I do that Ironman, I've earned the privilege of wearing spandex. The second the Ironman's over, a guy comes up to me and says, "Sir, we need you to put on this big, bulky shirt now." I get it. It's not for everyone. It's the same thing with having an audience. It's the same thing with having clients. So brevity, if I have 2.7 seconds to reach my audience, become a better communicator. Take a class. Take a writing class. Anyone who works for me can take a writing class or a speaking class for free. If you give presentations to audiences as you're pushing for new work, as you're pushing for clients, Take an improv class. It's a little cult-like. It's kind of like CrossFit, but they teach you how to answer questions. Take a writing class. With all the universities and the connections we have here, go audit a writing class. Good communication is brevity. Brevity is how to reach the socially connected consumer and the socially connected world of tomorrow. That's rule three. Final rule, rule four, is the concept of top of mind. And this is where everything I say sort of finites into a point. Back in the 70s, there was a guy by the name of Barry Diller. Barry Diller was the head of Paramount Pictures. He took the job, and everyone told him not to because Paramount Pictures at the time was about 2.5 feet from bankruptcy. He took the job, and he did two things. He got in the office an hour early every day. Never underestimate the power of getting up early. It'll change your life. But the more important thing he did was he would go into his office, and he'd go into his Rolodex. Crystal Rolodex, like Outlook, but it had cards. You'd turn it. Okay. He'd go into his Rolodex. Every sheet having to get such as a one. Oh, I'm going to get a one from her on that review sheet. I guarantee it. He'd go into his Rolodex, and he would pull out 10 people at random every day. And he would call those 10 people. Not to sell them, just to say hi. Hey, it's Barry. What are you working on in New York? Hey, it's Barry. How's the weather in London? What's going on in Chicago? How can I help? Those four words, how can I help, changed the course of Paramount Pictures. When you had a movie you wanted greenlit, you had an actor you wanted signed to a 5-picture deal, you could have gone to 20th Century Fox or Warner Brothers, or you could have called Barry back. Because chances are, you got 3 or 4 calls a year from Barry Diller asking how he could help you. When you had something to give him, that's where you went. Barry Diller took Paramount Pictures in 10 years from 2 feet from bankruptcy, 2.5 feet from bankruptcy, to the first $1 billion studio in the world with Top Gun, Flashdance, Footloose, Beverly Hills Cop, Three Men and a Baby, Officer and a Gentleman. He flat out destroyed everyone else in Hollywood by reaching out and saying hi. Why does that matter? Because there are a lot of people who do what you do. And what did I say in the beginning? It comes down at the end of the day to your brand, because that's all you're selling. You're selling trust, and you're selling your brand. Your brand needs to be thought of first when people are thinking about the industry you're in. How does that happen? You offer help. The concept of reaching out to your audience when you have nothing to sell, but just to say hi. 98% of the emails that I send out to my database, and I have a database now of about 500,000 people in my email database, not including Harrow. I sold Harrow. 98% of those emails don't have an ask. They're, hey, I heard an interesting story yesterday. I thought you'd find it interesting. Hey, I just found out there's this discount on whatever. There's a discount on roses for next week's Valentine's Day. Thought you might want it. Those are my emails. And you know what happens to them? They get read, and then people respond, Peter, that's really funny you reached out to me. I'm actually looking for a keynote speaker for an event next month. I'm so glad you're... If I had sent an email and said, hi, I'm looking for more keynote gigs, please... Not so much. We all have that friend who sends us the email. We haven't heard from them in 5 years, and they send us an email that looks personalized. Marty, hey, how are you, is the subject line. You open it up, and it says, Marty, good to hear from you. How's everything? Listen, I'm running a 10K for charity, and I'd love it if you donated... I haven't heard from you in 5 years. And the first email I get from you tells me to send money. I don't care how good the charity is. That's just not cool. Knowing your audience and reaching out to them when you don't need anything does two things. Number one, it makes you top of mind. And number two, it gives you more cushion when you screw up. Because if I reach out to my audience every week with things that are good and helpful, when I screw up, they're still going to have my back. And the nicest thing about an audience that has your back is they're going to stand up for you when people say they suck. Oh, I never use a company. Actually, no. I've used them several times. They're really good. They did this thing for me. No one believes how great you are if you're the one that has to tell them. But if the people telling people how great you are not you, you will get them. It's the concept that you focus on the customers you have, you focus on the clients you have, to get the clients you want. Reaching out when you don't have anything to sell. Create Google alerts on your top people. create Google Alerts on your least top people. And when something interesting happens in their world and they get a Google Alert from it, send them a note. I do that with, I probably have close to 1,000 Google Alerts. Maybe I'll get 2 or 3 a day. It takes 5 seconds as I'm on a plane or somewhere to reach for my phone and say, Mark, saw you made the New York Times. Dude, great job. Reach out if I can ever help. Congratulations again, Peter. Done. That is religion to me. I do that every single day. Someone emailed and asked a question. One of the questions that I got last night was, how do I handle email and all the emails that come in with everything else that I have to do in my life? I would argue, and I know the answer you're looking for was, oh, don't worry about the emails, just focus on your goals. I would argue that your goal is your emails. Learn to write quicker responses. I have a secret that I go into detail in the book about this, but I call it short burst downtime. Short burst downtime is the basic premise that we all have a minimum of 2 hours a day in our lives that we're not doing anything with, that we're wasting doing other things. When we're online at the bank, when we are waiting for our lunch order, when we are in the bathroom, whatever it is. Don't lie, we all do it. We have time where we're not doing anything. That's the time that you should be scanning Facebook, commenting happy birthday, whatever the case may be, answering emails, all those little downtime things. And the funny thing is that because I'm so ADHD, I have to live religiously by those rules or I don't get anything done. And if you want to find out, feel free to come up and talk to me about it. I love talking about that stuff later. But the basic premise is you have the ability to create change just by being a little bit nicer. And that starts with asking your audience, how can I help you? Because when you do screw up, like the PR firm that sent me an email last week, dear Peter, we know that being a mom is hard. You must know more than I do, because I'm pretty sure I'm Jess's dad. I like the guys. And 5 seconds later, I get an email back, says, dear Peter, we know that being a mom is hard. And you know what else is hard? Obviously doing email lists. We are so sorry. I'm like, you know what? You guys rock. You're back in my book. So your goal at the end of the day, own it. Be transparent. Be relevant to your audience. Understand the concept of brevity. And be helpful. Your job is not to create magical moments. Look, it's great to create magical moments. And I'll leave you on 2 stories. First story is this. I was flying home from Newark Airport, from Florida to Newark Airport about 5 years ago. I jokingly sent a tweet. Hey, Morton Steakhouse, I'm starving. Why don't you meet me with a porterhouse when I land at Newark in 3 hours? Ha 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 ha. It was sent the same way you'd tweet, hey, winter, please stop snowing. I landed at Newark Airport. I find my driver. Standing next to my driver is a guy in a tuxedo with a Morton's bag. Morton's saw the tweet. Morton's corporate saw the tweet, called Morton's in Hackensack, wherever the hell in New Jersey, prepared a meal, sent a waiter to deliver it to me at a steak. Okay, that's awesome. But you know what? That's more PR than customer service, because Morton's job isn't to deliver a steak to the airport. Morton's job is to make sure you have a great experience when you go to the restaurant. If I got a steak at the airport and you went to Morton's and your steak was cold and they treated you like crap and you're half an hour late for your table, that just makes what they did for me even worse. Every time you go to Morton's, they say, when you make the reservation, are you celebrating anything? Oh yeah, it's my wife's birthday. What's her name? Her name's Michelle. Great, we'll see you and Michelle at 8 o'clock. You show up at 8 o'clock and you walk in, there's your table ready, you sit down, you know what's on the menu? Top of the menu, printed in paper, happy birthday, Michelle. It costs them nothing to do, but you know what happens next? Michelle takes out her phone, Instagrams the crap out of that for 45 minutes. I can't get a drink. Oh my God, one more picture, look. Who are Michelle's friends? People just like Michelle. What did Michelle's friends want? To be treated as well as Michelle was. Where are they gonna go? Morton's. That is not just a consumer thing, that applies to everything you do in your businesses today. Last story, swear to God, I know I'm off out of time. Last story. Remember I told you I just need you not to suck? The world at this point is gaining towards this one singularity, which is this. When I land in San Francisco and I type in steakhouses near me, or I say, need an educational tour, whatever it is, Google is going to show me steakhouses near me, or going to show me in the first page all the tours and the advertising. But you know where they're going to show me above that? And it's already starting. Steakhouses my friends have been to, tours my friends have taken. Yelp is dead in 2 years. TripAdvisor is dead. Those don't matter anymore. What matters is the connection I have with you. If you and I are friends, I'm going to trust your knowledge. And if I need to find a group to take my group and I start searching for it, your last trip is going to come up automatically with a link right to the phone number. And if the person at the other end of the phone is smart, they'll answer on the first ring. How do I phrase that in something that's even more fun? I was flying into Phoenix about 4 years ago, and I had a rental car with Hertz. And I'm a gold member with Hertz, which is like, it doesn't, it, doesn't mean anyone can be a gold member. It's like having a Discover card. But I had a gold member with Hertz, and so it just meant my name was on the wall, so I wouldn't have to go wait. So I go, I look at the wall, on the board, my name's not on there. Okay. I go to the counter. I go to the gold counter. There's a 45-minute wait at the gold counter. About 25 minutes in, the guy says, one guy on a computer says, you know, guys, you might be better if going upstairs to the main counter. I'm only one person here. Okay. Go upstairs to the main counter. There's a 2.5-hour wait at the main counter. I'm tweeting to Hertz. Hertz, I have a confirmed reservation. It would be awesome if more than just two of the 14 stations here were filled. Hello, anyone? I see people in the back. Not sure whether they're networking. No response. 2.5 hours later, I get to the counter. Guy says, how can I help you? I'm like, yeah, here's my reservation. I'm a gold member. Oh, you're a gold member. You have to go downstairs. I'm like, okay, let's put a pin in that. They sent me up here. No, it's policy. You have to go downstairs. So instead of going downstairs, I said, I can see my reservation. It's right. You can do this. I believe in you. No, they have to do it. It's not they. You're the same company. You can do nothing. Well, if you've ever been to Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport, all of the rental car counters are in the same building. So I literally walked 50 feet from the cesspool of filth and depravity that was Hertz, 50 feet to the Zen garden of peace and tranquility that was Avis. And when I got to Avis, I was met by a lovely woman named Phyllis, who worked at Avis in Phoenix and who moved to Phoenix from Detroit with her husband Walter because the air was better for her asthma. She told me all this. And she told me all this while getting me a nicer car at a lesser price, smiling the entire time. And when she handed me the keys, she even said, hang on a second, Ramon, come meet Mr. Shankman. Ramon is the Avis manager of Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. Come meet Mr. Shankman. He's another Hertz refugee. Now, I don't have an MBA, but I'm pretty sure that if your biggest competitor has a name for the people you continually screw over, you're going to want to get on that. And here's where it rambles to a point for you guys. The worst thing in the world is to piss me off and then have 4 hours to kill with me and nothing but a laptop and an internet connection, because I will write about it. And I wrote a blog post called, because I just had my kid at the time, so I wrote a blog post called Peter and Hertz and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Really Bad Customer Experience. And in this post, I listed how horrible Hertz was, how amazing Avis was, and I listed 5 things I'd rather do than ever rent from Hertz again. And number 3, I believe, was drive a razor blade bus through a lemon juice waterfall. And the next morning, I published the post, and 5 minutes later, I get a call from the head of North American Global for Hertz, and Mr. Shankman, hi! So it seems you have a problem. How can we fix it? I'm like, well, you could have fixed it yesterday. But I'm pretty sure that the only reason you're calling me right now is because someone in a much higher position of power than you woke your ass up and said, fix this, right? Except I was tweeting out all day yesterday, I have an Avis car now. I'm very happy with them. Thank you. Goodbye. Every time I tell the story, I elaborate more, right? I tell, you know, Hertz kills kittens when they test their cars. But here's the part that matters to you guys. How do you be a little bit better? I got a letter in the mail the next week from Avis, and it wasn't, thanks so much for mentioning us. You know what the letter said, Mr. Shankman? We want to thank you so much for your blog post that highlighted our employee, Phyllis. We really care about every single one of our employees, and we love the fact that you mentioned her. By the way, did you know that she moved from Detroit? Yes, I know, the asthma. Long story short, at the end of the day, what can you do to just be a little better, prove that you're human, and become a trusted brand? Throw that last slide, the one slide I have, to give you some idea of how much of a trusted brand I am. That's my actual cell phone number. It rings to this phone. And I encourage you to use it. If you're ever in New York, I encourage you to reach out. I'm always happy to go for a run. I'm always happy to get a coffee. I'm always happy to talk about this. I don't charge for it. I just think it's the right thing to do. It's good karma. I'm at Peter Shankman on the socials. bit.ly/notesfromps is my mailing list where I do give away all that good content for free. That's my email. Shankminds is a private mastermind I run. It's a group where we just talk about this stuff nonstop. There are actually a couple of Shankminds members in the audience. I would love for you to join us. I will be in the back with my books. I know it's early. I know you spent an hour with me, and I am truly, truly appreciative. Thank you very much. Whoever's calling me from 415, yes, it really is my cell phone number. See? Thank you.
Thanks so much. All right. Let's give Peter another round of applause for his great talk this morning.